From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Clinton and Trump campaigns converge on Michigan, ending with a late-night rally by Donald Trump in downtown Grand Rapids.
Yeah, when it's all said and done, Donald Trump will probably be in Michigan, technically on Election Day.
She was an economic advisor in the Nixon White House, and she is not buying the jobs promises from either presidential candidate.
The likelihood that, quote, Joe's jobs will come back is just smoking dope.
John U. Bacon on that stunner of a Lions win.
So what they did is very cool, very clever, and very disciplined. Three things I never use in describing the Lions.
And the Seraphine Collective working to promote inclusion in Detroit's music and art scene. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The long and winding campaign road ends up in Michigan for both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. On this final day of the campaign, President Obama held a rally for Hillary Clinton earlier today in Ann Arbor. Clinton herself is at Grand Valley State University in West Michigan. Donald Trump and Governor Mike Pence will wrap up their campaign with a rally at 11 tonight in downtown Grand Rapids. We've got Chad Livengood of the Detroit News here with us. An incredibly busy day, Chad. Why has Michigan become the belle of the ball?
Well, because basically Donald Trump has to win Michigan. In addition to the other big swing states of Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio, he needs to take a blue state, and Michigan has been blue every year since Bill Clinton was elected president in 1992. So this is his battleground, and this is the wall, the firewall for the Clintons, and they are here in force. Especially with the president here, he had 8,000 people at Ray Fisher Stadium at the University of Michigan, and Hillary Clinton is going to be in West Michigan making her first trek west of U.S. 23 in this election.
We saw a pretty significant difference, I think, between what the public polls are telling us and what those private internal campaign polls reveal. Do you have a sense, Chad, of what the internal polls are telling the Clinton and Trump camps? Is it closer than what we think it is?
Yeah, they are. I mean, the public polling is kind of range between 4 to 7%. If you get under 4%, you're within a margin of error. So that's when Donald Trump starts saying the poll is even, or we're even in Michigan, that's statistically a term of stats. And so they're looking at tracking polls in the 2 or 3% range. There's some other pollsters out there that think it's dead even. And this is really a turnout game. I mean, Hillary Clinton now has actually put out $2 million between her campaign and her super PAC in the last week in television advertising in Michigan. Donald Trump's about $750,000. But at the end of the day, this campaign isn't really being fought on the air, or hasn't been. It's going to be fought on the ground, and it's about turning out people. So that's why Donald Trump was in Sterling Heights Sunday night, trying to boost his already solid base in Macomb County, try to repair some of his problems he has in Oakland County. And then he's in West Michigan for the same reason, try to repair some of the problems he's had with Republicans out there. This is an area, you recall, that Ted Cruz won the congressional districts in around Grand Rapids in the primary in March, and did well in Southwest Michigan as well. So Mike Pence was in Kalamazoo last week. He was in Holland on Saturday. He's in Traverse City today. Lansing, 4 out of 5 days, Mike Pence is here. He is, seen by the conservative evangelicals as one of them, while Donald Trump has not always been viewed as one of them. So that's a big part of the strategy here, and that's why they decided to make this late dash back to Grand Rapids tonight for 11 p.m. rally, probably going to be closer to midnight. I mean, when it's all said and done, Donald Trump will probably be in Michigan technically on Election Day.
You know, Chad, last Thursday I talked with your Detroit News colleague Daniel Howes about all of this focus on Michigan by the campaigns. And this is what he had to say about President Obama hitting the campaign trail for Secretary Clinton.
If you see him come in here over the weekend and come to Detroit, I think that would be a real sign that they're very concerned that they're losing traction.
So here we are. It's Monday, and we get word the president's at the University of Michigan. Is Daniel's take correct?
Well, the difference here is he came to Ann Arbor, and there is a one reason that I was told by a high-level Democrat in the state that he could not come to Detroit today because there was a funeral for a police officer from Detroit who was killed in a hit-run accident midday at a large African-American church, and it would have tied up the whole city if the president had come into Detroit. So they picked the University of Michigan, obviously Ann Arbor, bastion of liberalism, his stronghold for Barack Obama. But yeah, I mean, they made a decision on Saturday to send the president here, and it's still very significant. He's going to end his day also in Pennsylvania, another blue state that Trump is trying to crack. Him and Hillary Clinton are going to have a rally in Independence Mall in Philadelphia tonight.
So really, it's like battling over blue states like Michigan. And I'm wondering what all of these campaign appearances and all the heavy schedules of campaign ads might mean for down ballot in Michigan. What are you thinking? What are you hearing?
Well, just a few weeks ago, I mean, Republicans were bracing for a bloodbath. I mean, they were preparing for losing the state House representatives and essentially getting wiped out on statewide Board of Education seats. That the people were speculating that Brooks Patterson, titan of Republican politics and longtime executive of Oakland County, could go down. And now that has all changed with the momentum of the Trump campaign, with the changing dynamics from the FBI's announcement of its renewed investigation into the Clinton email server, which the FBI director essentially cleared Hillary Clinton of yesterday. That changed the momentum and has really narrowed the polls in all these down ballot races. So it will be really close to watch, especially the congressional race in the 8th district between Susanna Shirelli and Congressman Mike Bishop, the Republican incumbent. But it's not looking as good for Democrats now, given the momentum that Donald Trump has had swinging his way in the last 7 days.
Chad, what will you be keeping your eye on most closely tomorrow as we start to see results come in?
Yeah, we're going to watch the traditional battlegrounds of Oakland County. Macomb County obviously is favored in Trump. And then Kent County, if he somehow lags behind Mitt Romney's numbers from 2012, that'll be a sign that he had more problems out there than we knew, especially among women voters. There's been plenty of polling to suggest that he's got a problem with moderate and Republican women voters. And this will show up, if it really comes to fruition, this will show up in Oakland and Kent County, where it's really crucial. He may not win Oakland County, but he needs to keep that Hillary Clinton's margins somewhere closer to 7-8%, which is what Mitt Romney lost Oakland County, where he grew up, to Barack Obama by that amount. So those are the two keys. Another bellwether to always watch for is Kalamazoo County, and that might be why Mike Pence was out there the other day. Kalamazoo County has a tendency to predict which person prevails overall in the presidential race.
Well, a busy, busy day for reporters like Chad Livengood of the Detroit News, crisscrossing around the state, following all the candidates. Chad, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
The Next Idea's Jeff DeGraff has been looking at the presidential election through a Hollywood lens lately. Simple plots, easy explanations, and tidy endings may sell movie tickets and win elections, but real life is a lot more complicated.
One of my favorite movies from last year was The Big Short. It brilliantly explained many of the complex factors that set into motion the collapse of the subprime mortgage market. It also captured the arrogance of the age. But the movie got one thing wrong. It suggested that only a few insiders understood what was really happening, when in fact many professionals and academics knew as early as 2003 that a crash was coming. The real problem was that the people who had developed this deep expertise were either ignored or criticized by leaders who could dismiss their insights as too difficult to understand or too complex to be of any real consequence. They replaced these faint warnings with the reassuring bravado of the great and powerful Oz. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. The true believers thought the financial wizards had done their homework and had their best interests at heart. They lost it all. Most importantly, they lost faith in the system. If you don't think simplicity sells, listen to the messages from the campaign trail. We're going to build a great wall that spans the 2,000-mile border with Mexico. Since no one has undertaken such an effort in ages, we might want to consult some folks in Beijing or Berlin as to the cost and engineering required to really get the job done right. Or perhaps you'd prefer the opposition. The same party that couldn't get a single conviction on the thieves who mugged the economy is now going to extract from them the $75 billion needed to make college education free for everyone? Maybe we should consult the odds makers before betting on this one. Marketers, politicians, and scammers alike make the complex seem simple because it excuses them from having to actually understand the situation. It also allows them complete deniability. They can say they were simply misinformed. The truth is, they were never informed. Founding Father Thomas Paine warned that a poorly informed public would be easily coerced by the cunning and the predatory. Well, here we are now. We're being given simple answers for simple people. Think back to the horde of financial experts who promised that the go-go real estate markets that preceded the Big Short would go on and on. There are only two plausible explanations for what they did. They were either great pretenders out of their depth or duplicitous liars trying to get what they could while the going was good. Why didn't we listen to the expert fact checkers? Because simple is easier to sell. We all want simplicity, but modernity is complex. Economics, politics, the job, the commute, the whole shebang. We can't embrace simplicity until after we've worked through complexity. Your iPhone, your Google search, your package delivery are all made simple because legions of scientists, engineers, and designers first delved into the depths of complexity. In most of our jobs, we use our specialized expertise to navigate our way through the complex entanglements. So why are we letting our candidates treat us like simpletons? Why not ask them the hard questions like, how will that work? How much will it cost? How did you come up with that number? And that showstopper, where exactly will the money come from? You would ask the same questions to someone who is going to remodel your kitchen. Why not ask them to someone who claims they're going to remodel your country? Or we can go on believing that it's really all that simple until the next Big Short. But by then it will be simply too late.
Jeff DeGraff is an expert on innovation with the Ross School of Business and our partner in The Next Idea. His views do not necessarily reflect those of Michigan Radio or its license holder, the Regents of the University of Michigan.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You getting bored with serving up the same old veggies day in and day out? Well, that is your cue to think seasonal, just the way folks did in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Right now, you can be turning your attention to fall root vegetables, the ones you might never have thought of picking up, buying, and serving. Here with us is Tom Becker of Sunseed Farm in Ann Arbor with a basket full of these oft-forgotten fall root vegetables. Tom, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
I think that idea that I remember from talking to a food historian, it really does hold true that, we've fallen out of the habit of seasonally serving things up because we can go and buy a bag of something in the freezer. But we're missing out on something if we don't kind of listen to the seasons, aren't we?
I think you're right. I mean, a long time ago, before the advent of our global food system and refrigeration and all that, we really developed a strong culinary tradition in each of our regions. And part of that in Michigan was growing these hardy root vegetables and other storage vegetables to get us through the winter. Although we've lost that culinary tradition, we've even lost some of the words. We don't know what these vegetables, we see them in the grocery store, see them at the market and no idea what they are, but they're delicious, they're hardy. And we can sort of regain that connection with, our past and our ancestors who lived here.
Start with, what's the first one you want us to start with?
I'd like to start with kohlrabi.
Kohlrabi. And I've seen that, K-O-H-L-R-A-B-I, which is just an exotic name in and of itself.
Yeah, it's delicious. So it looks like a root. A lot of folks look at it and think that it's a root crop, but it's actually a swollen stem. So it's an old vegetable. The way I describe it, it kind of seems like a cross between a cabbage and an apple.
Yeah, because it has an apple-y look to it.
When you cut it open, it's got a bright green skin, and that skin is really tough. And so you want it, when you're opening it up, you want to take the first couple layers off the outside, and you're left with this beautiful white inside that's very crisp and very delicious.
That it is. Oh, it is really good. It's a little firmer than an apple. Oh, it's delicious. I could see dipping this in hummus or
yeah, folks Lubney pretend like or... it's an apple, pretend like it's a water chestnut, or you can grate it into a slaw.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a similar – sort of the flavor is a little bit similar to a broccoli stem or the heart of a cabbage, but a little bit milder and a little bit sweeter. It's also really good just sautéed at high heat or roasted. You know, as it softens up, it mellows out and gets a little bit more sweet. I personally like to leave a little bit of life left in it when I cook it, though, so it still takes some of that crunch. It's one of my favorites.
Now – rutabaga, which I kind of remember from my – I know my mother grew up on a farm, and I think as a kid we would have rutabaga served. Remind us again what that looks – oh, there it is. It's like this enormous onion on steroids or something.
Yeah,
it's huge.
It's definitely a presence in the room when it comes
is.
Out. So a rutabaga is a – it's a wild cross between a turnip – and sort of the precursors of cabbage and broccoli and those kinds of things. So it's called by a lot of different names, the tumshi, the neep, the snaggers. and, you know, it's got that – you can think of it as a sort of like a potato, but it has a little bit of a turnipy flavor. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice. People use it as, you know, just as like a flavor addition to all kinds of different cooking. But it's also really tasty by itself or just, you know, roasted and having, you know, in whole chunks with other – you know, roasted root vegetables or other storage vegetables like that.
So is it pretty easy to, you know, you get your slices and get that big sturdy skin off and
yeah,
you're good
well,
to go?
You know, there's not much of a skin to it. You can peel it if you like, but there's not much of a toughness to the skin. And a lot of times we like to save the skins on these vegetables because that's where a lot of the most important vitamins are. But there is a little bit of a hazard when you start to hack into it. You want to make sure that you have a sturdy knife. Because it is so large, if you slip, you might end up hurting yourself.
So be careful there.
But, you know, this is it's a really old vegetable. People have been using it for a long time all over the world. And there's even other traditions associated with it besides just eating it. In Britain and in Ireland, up until about 20 years ago when the pumpkin took its place, the rutabaga was used as jack-o'-lanterns, you know, to ward off evil spirits over Halloween time.
You're right.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it came across with our, you know, Finnish roots here in Michigan, and it's been well represented and still is in the UP with pasties.
My late Irish mother-in-law often would serve a combination. She would mash carrots and turnips together. And you get a really interesting mash that way. So I would suspect these play well with other veggies.
They certainly do, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of these vegetables, you can kind of treat them the same way, roast them up together, put them in soups, stir fry them, eat them raw. Just got to keep trying them, you know, try the different ways.
Now, what's our third veggie?
The third one is celeriac.
Okay. And that's C-E-L-E-R-I-A-C. Oh, look at him. Okay. And I see what you're saying. Totally root. We'll have to get pictures of these and put them up so everybody can see.
They're strange looking. And
yes.
A lot of times you see them, they're a lot bigger than this. But, you know, when you first look at it, if it doesn't have the leaves and the stalks attached to it, you might think that it's some sort of undersea creature, some sort of Medusa or something.
With its tentacles.
Yeah. And they have generally have all sorts of little fine roots attached to them. So they're a little bit intimidating when you first look at them.
Yeah.
You think, what is this?
Well, then what do you do with this?
So you can think of it like it's just a celery. It's a variety of celery that has been bred over time to have this thick bulbous root.
Okay.
And it's got a great celery flavor without any of the stringiness to it. It has a really nice nutty flavor as well. And again, kind of the same as the other two.
Yeah.
Great roasted. It's one of my favorite roasted vegetables. Just has that really rich celery flavor. And it also, its flavor is potent enough that you can use it to flavor soups and other things really well.
I absolutely get the celery smell.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. You know, it is a celery.
Yeah,
so you look at the – and then the stalks.
Yeah.
You can think of them just as celery, but they're going to be a little tougher than the celery that you might find in the store that's really big and luscious and blanched and nice to eat raw. This would be a great addition to any kind of soups or soup stocks that you're making just to add that really lovely celery flavor.
Would you do anything with the greens?
Yeah, I'd chop them up and put them in a soup stock.
Put them in a soup stock. So yep. You've got – you can really make – what about the others? I mean, can we kind of use any of those greens that that are presented with the other ones, or some more than others?
You can, yeah. The rutabaga greens and the kohlrabi greens would be pretty much – the rutabaga greens might be a little spicier, kind of like radish greens. But the kohlrabi greens, you could think of them just as interchangeable with kale or collard greens.
So you could do a nice sauté or something.
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness me. Well, we're hoping those of you listening might have a favorite dish of kohlrabi, rutabaga, or celeriac. If so, send us your recipe and your name and contact information, and we might feature your recipe on our website. Just send those recipes to stateside@michiganradio.org. I'm so glad you've got me thinking of this, because I would not have. It's the kind of thing where you look, go, oh, I don't know what to do with that. I'm going to buy those carrots. So nothing against carrots, but this is the time.
Yeah, you know, Michigan is hugely agriculturally diverse state. We can grow all sorts of wonderful things. These are the things that are going to get us through the hard winter. They're going to keep us, you know, well fed, and they're going to warm up our kitchens as we're cooking them through the winter. And connecting with these older vegetables that you might not normally see in the stores, it's just a way to reconnect with our landscape, our agricultural heritage, and the culinary heritage that, you know, our ancestors in these parts had.
Tom Becker with Sunseed Farm in Ann Arbor. Thank you so much. Great ideas, and I can't wait to try these. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Being a musician can be tough. The lifestyle, brutal. Apart from trying to create and then build an audience for what you're creating, there's the intense competition. And the music business has long been dominated by men, especially on the business and production sides, which means all too often women artists have even bigger mountains to climb. Which is why the Seraphine Collective is becoming more and more important to female-identified artists in the Detroit area. This is a Michigan nonprofit group of women working to promote inclusion in Detroit's music and art scene. With us now, two members of the Seraphine Collective, Dina Bencoli, welcome.
Hi.
And to Rachel Thompson. So good to have you both with us.
Thanks.
I'll let you start, Dina. How do you describe the Seraphine Collective?
Seraphine Collective is basically a feminist music and arts collective based in Detroit, and our mission is to foster camaraderie and a space for underrepresented people in the music scene, which is mostly women, LGBTQ persons, people of color, who are normally or way too often kind of left out of the conversation.
What does that look like, that being left out and not having kind of a safe space to just be?
Basically having to work much harder than men do, not being taken as seriously when they are coming to shows. People think that they aren't even able to use their own equipment, being catcalled.
I think it's just access to opportunities, which is a large problem. It's the people that own the venues. It's the people that are doing booking. It's promotion, even like recording studios. Oftentimes it's who you know. And sometimes it's kind of hard to break into a scene if you don't know the right people.
But even as you're trying to do that, and I'll kind of get back to that whole sexual undercurrent, there is someone I know firsthand that had been booked to perform at a venue, was very pleased about that. And then several weeks in, the owner comes in and starts hitting on her. Oh, see, I'm seeing you pull faces. Not a new story, is that?
No, no.
So what is the Seraphine Collective able to do to make that not happen, Rachel?
Basically, the shows that we book, we always make sure that we have women. One of the things that we've started doing at some of our shows is that we've created a safe space policy. We had a festival last July called BFF Fest. We created a safety team. So there were people who worked in shifts every couple of hours who were kind of keeping an eye out and making sure that the policy was enforced. And they were available if anyone was feeling unsafe in any way.
Whether audience or artist.
Yeah, audience or artist. So something that we're hoping to do in the future is continue on with this safety team and create community dialogues that we hope to have in different places across the city where we start to gather stories of people's experiences of harassment within the music scene. And then something that we hope to do with that is create maybe like a zine or a training of some sort where we can offer that to venue owners, bartenders, door guys, just giving them actual stories that have occurred at their venues.
Dina, I know the collective kind of came to be in late 2013. So there's about 3 years now of activities. What are some of the initiatives or the actions? I know you mentioned, Rachel, the BFF Best Fest forever, right?
Yes.
But what are some of the other ways that the Seraphine Collective is active?
We mentioned we present shows at local venues around town. We're trying to get our own venue, but until we do, local venues have been really open in receiving us and allowing us to book shows. We also have a quarterly zine and mixtape. So we'll have local bands and artists, as well as traveling bands that are playing our shows, contribute to a mixtape. We actually make cassettes and put them out so we can really showcase what's going on in the local scene and kind of give people an opportunity to put out a cassette. The zine, we have local writing and artwork, reviews that we publish in a printed zine. We have a monthly DJ night at UFO Factory. The first couple of nights were actually DJed by our, quote, baby DJs. We actually had a DJ workshop called Beat Mash Brunch, and we taught, how many DJs did we have, Rachel?
We had 8.
We taught them how to DJ pretty much, and now they're out there DJing around the city, being awesome.
And this is all for female-identified artists? Is that the idea?
Yes.
What about genres?
Any genre, really.
All comers welcome.
It started out mainly as a rock collective, and we've kind of been trying to branch out more recently. One of the ways that we've been trying to branch out is by doing interviews that we post on our blog, which is how the Seraphine Collective started to begin with. And then also on the mixtape, we've been trying to curate it a little bit more to include techno, house music, hip-hop. And that was another thing that was really important to us at our festival this past year.
Dina, what is the role in your mind of musicians and artists in helping to strengthen Detroit?
I think we have a really great music and arts community in Detroit. Music and art really help bring people together. Whether you do music or art yourself, it's something that a lot of people are interested in. It's something that naturally kind of brings people together.
And we need a lot of that.
Yes.
We need a lot of that. And Rachel, I know social work and social justice is part of your life. What can the Seraphine Collective, do you think, mean for social justice and for neighborhoods?
Well, kind of tying it into the last question, something that I think is extremely unique about Detroit is how tied activism is to music. I do a lot of grassroots organizing in my neighborhood in Southwest Detroit, and I would say that pretty much every activist I meet will also then be like, hey, would you also like to come to my DJ night or come see me perform at my hip hop show? Or, you know, everybody's an artist who's an activist, who I know at least, who I do organizing with. That is definitely a way that music can connect people in Detroit. And as Dina was saying, it's just a way to form actual authentic relationships with people instead of just, hey, let's have this protest or hey, let's do this. I think that having fun together and listening to music is kind of a very important first step in organizing in the city.
Do either of you ever think that through the work that you're doing with this collective, like the Seraphine Collective, so a safe space for women-identified musicians and artists to create and to be and to express themselves, could that work ultimately lead to not needing a Seraphine Collective anymore? Would you like to put yourself out of business, I guess I'm wondering, where we just are artists and it isn't a matter of needing to have that kind of safe space?
I guess ideally in a world that could be equal like that. But we also are very focused on people of color and LGBTQ people, so who are, you know, a smaller portion of the population. So in a fantasy future where everything is awesome, maybe, but for the next 50, 100 years, I think there's still a lot of work to be done.
I think we'll be around for a minute.
Would you like to replicate what you're doing in other areas in Michigan?
Yeah, we definitely would. I think that we already kind of are. I mean, for the festival at least, we've brought in people from a bunch of different places outside of Detroit. And even going beyond Michigan, something that we've begun to learn is that there are a lot of other groups doing similar things, and we're really hoping to be able to connect with them. Who are the groups in Canada?
There's Babley Shades in Ottawa. There's a festival that actually happens around the same time as our festival, BFF Fest, called Slut Island. And we are definitely hoping to link up with them next year and kind of have an exchange. So, yeah, we're definitely reaching out to more collectives, and we're hoping to have some real concrete, like, exchange of ideas. And
who do you hope might hear us talking and say, you know what, I'm going to SeraphineCollective.org to check them out? Who do you hope to hear from?
Everyone. Yeah. Any feminist, activists. I think it's really cool when people come who have never played music before. and who really, really have always wanted to but didn't feel like they could. Because we've seen out of people who have met through our meetings, people form bands and play. And that's something that is also really important to us, not just promoting bands who are already super cool and people mm-hmm. like them, but being able to uplift people and encourage people when they're maybe not quite as good yet.
Yeah, definitely. As someone who plays in bands, I'd love for people just to come and meet others and form bands or maybe make their own groups or collectives just to expand our universe of...
Well, and realize that you've got a voice and your Seraphine Collective is going to help you try to get that voice out there.
Yeah, it's just creating opportunities for ourselves and others. And it's definitely possible. I think being in Detroit right now is like a really unique time because so many things are possible, not just in terms of real estate or things like that. It's just as a city that's very receptive to arts and music, we can make things happen. And it's really, really inspiring and fun.
Dina Bancoli and Rachel Thompson, board members of the Seraphine Collective. And you can learn what they're up to and how you might get involved very easily. Just go to seraphinecollective.org. That's seraphinecollective.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. John, what word would you use to describe that Cubs win? Okay, even two or three words?
If I can do dashes, hyphens, once in a lifetime.
Amazing.
108 years, of course. When you go back to when they last won it, Oklahoma was the 46th state. So GM was born, of course, and Mother's Day was celebrated for the very first time. Mother's Day. Hmm. So that's how long ago that was.
That was a thrilling game, and I'm not one to think baseball's thrilling, but everything about every moment of that game was thrilling.
It was taut with tension except for the 3 minutes between half innings for ads. That part's a killer when you have the stadium, but it was a great game. Look, these guys were down 3-1 in games, got caught twice during the last game, of course, game 7, and win it in the 10th inning, and God bless them. So if you're a Cubs fan, by the way, I don't know why you're in work today because better than dress for 108 years.
And as so many people are saying, hey, if the Cubbies won the World Series, the Lions can make it to the Super Bowl. And they won yesterday. I know, you're kind of making a face. Now, let me ask you, did you expect to see that victory yesterday? Did you expect to see that game going into overtime?
Absolutely not.
So what about that last 23 seconds?
Amazing, by the way. And they did it the right way. They were deep in their own zone. They had to get all the way down there to get a field goal. So they had one pass, quick one to the sideline for 9 yards, and then they went right up the middle with no timeouts. Now, the trick to this, non-sports fans, is the other team is covering the out-of-bounds lines because if you get out of bounds, the clock stops. So that's a free timeout, basically. If you go up the middle, the clock will not stop. They're out of timeouts. So what they did is very cool, very clever, and very disciplined. Three things I never use in describing the Lions. Matt Stafford, the quarterback, looking surprisingly good, goes right up the middle. They run up the field as fast as they can after the whistle to spike the ball, to stop the clock, and the kicker comes in and hits a 58-yard field goal. Those three things right there are things you do not see the Lions do, and then they're very smart and over time and got
Golden
a touchdown.
Tate had that beautiful touchline dancer at the end. That was
Golden
really
Tate
something.
Is very good. If you are a Michigan State or a Michigan fan, you recall Golden Tate as the wide receiver at Notre Dame, who did a lot of damage on both those teams, but now he's on your team, the Lions. So the Lions are 5-4. In the NFL, where mediocrity sells, 5-4 is considered excellent.
Got to get your thoughts on what has turned into a true annus horribilis for Michigan State. 2-7 on the season, and they haven't won a game in the Big Ten. Is it bad players? Is it injured players? What's going on?
It's not bad players. It is a lot of injuries. It's a conflict. I hear my sources tell me between the senior grinders who earned all this and the hotshot freshmen who have not earned this and they're higher rated. So you have a conflict in the locker room. You have no leadership. So intangibles at the college level count for a lot. D'Antonio is one heck of a good coach. He built it once. He can rebuild it again. But this year, they cannot wait to throw away and start over.
I wonder how this is affecting him.
I have to say he's handled it extremely well. He's been calm and focused on TV. He's not blamed his players or his coaches. He's taken the hit. He's not given up, it seems like. But this can't be fun.
Oh, I can only imagine. And then, of course, Michigan's blowout over Maryland kept that Wolverine train rolling along nicely. We've got Iowa next weekend, then Indiana. Let's jump past that to the big one, Ohio State on the 26th. My birthday, by the way.
Happy birthday in advance, Cindy Canty.
Based on everything you've been seeing so far, care to make any predictions?
I thought that Ohio State was much better than Michigan when the season started. And they've been closing the gap ever since. Now I think it's about even. and I would not have said that a month ago. I think they still have weaknesses at Michigan. The offensive line is good but not great. They can't get injured on the offensive line between Iowa and Indiana up to Ohio State. They got five guys in the front line. Those guys have no one behind them. If they lose one of those guys, they're in big trouble, and Ohio State, not Iowa, not Indiana, those guys will exploit it. But Ohio State's got their own problems right now. They're in a dogfight against Wisconsin. They lost to Penn State. They're in a dogfight with Northwestern, which you don't hear very often. So that is not a powerhouse team right now.
So could be a really interesting 26th
of November. Got to call it about a toss-up right now because playing in the Horseshoe, which is their stadium, is one of the toughest places to play in America. They got balconies. They're right on top of you, and you hear everything.
Should be great. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. As always, thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
All through the presidential campaign, free trade has been one of the hot issues bubbling away on the national front burner. A lot of campaign rhetoric's been about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This proposed trade deal among the U.S., Canada, and 10 nations in the Asia-Pacific region could cover 40% of America's imports and exports. We're now in the first year of a two-year ratification period. Donald Trump has bashed the TPP every chance he's gotten. Hillary Clinton once praised it as the gold standard of trade deals, but she's backed away from that support. So let's talk more about free trade pros and cons as we welcome economist Marina von Neumann-Whitman. She's a professor of business administration and public policy at the University of Michigan. And Marina was the first woman ever appointed to the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Good to have you back on Stateside, Marina.
Well, it's a delight to be here, Cynthia. Thank you.
You prefer the term trade liberalization over free trade. Why so?
Well, because that's what trade agreements really are about. It's not, you know, that you either have free trade or you don't have free trade. It doesn't work that way. You either have more restrictions on trade or you have fewer restrictions on trade. And that's what trade agreements which focus on trade liberalization is all about.
And what's the economist's argument in favor of trade liberalization? What do we get as a nation?
Economists don't agree on many things. But virtually all economists agree that trade liberalization is good for a country as a whole. It tends to raise gross national product, encourage faster growth, encourage competition and innovation. Where I think, frankly, our profession fell down is although we would always pay a sentence or two of attention to the fact that they're winners and losers. And while the people who pay the cost are many fewer than the ones who gain, the fact is it's much more personal and intense for them. The people who gain may not even know that they're gaining from trade liberalizations. The people who lose a job or have to take a job at lower wages are focusing their anger on trade liberalization. Often, when that is not a primary cause, there's a good deal of evidence that people have lost manufacturing jobs in particular a lot more to automation than they have to freer trade. But it's kind of hard to vent your fury on a robot.
There you go. So as an economist, what's your take, Marina, as if you've heard the candidates talking about trade over the past 20 months, the campaign trail promises we're going to bring these good jobs back.
And that's nonsense. Those jobs aren't going to come back. I mean, you can always find, and any good journalist can find one example or a couple of examples, and I'm sure they will. But if you look at the data, what actually happens, the jobs that have disappeared have either gone to automation or to the fact that Americans are buying a lot more services than they are goods these days, or some of them indeed have gone off to other countries. But, you know, the big whipping boy is China. An awful lot of those jobs aren't even in China anymore. They've moved on to Bangladesh or Vietnam or goodness knows where. So the likelihood that, quote, Joe's jobs will come back is just smoking dope.
So let's talk about TPP. What would killing TPP do? Would it tip the balance in favor of China?
Yes, but not in terms of economics. The thing that worries me most about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is, yes, we would lose some potential for higher income and growth, but that's not the big point. The big point is, to put it bluntly, national security. The United States is locked in a real competition with China for domination in Asia, and particularly Southeast Asia. We haven't been doing too well on that lately. The president of the Philippines, who insists he's going to separate from us in language that can't be repeated here. Malaysia is doing some of the same thing. And China has already in the works its own version of TPP called RCEP. Let me try to think of Regional Comprehensive Economic Program, I think it is. And they've already signed on a number of Asian nations. So it's not like there's a vacuum there. If we don't do it, China will have the field to itself. And that has to be a bad thing for the United States.
What should we be doing as a nation for the folks who bear the cost of this 21st century economy, who have lost jobs?
Well, I think there are a number of things. Whether politically we can make them happen is quite another question. And as I think about what might make it possible for Hillary Clinton to flip again, because she flipped on TPP. One, we do have to enforce the things in trade agreements or in the World Trade Organization rules where some of our trading partners have been playing dirty. I think we don't focus well when we focus on Chinese currency manipulation, because although they have probably done it in the past, they don't seem to be doing it now. But there are a bunch of other things they're doing that we could really call them on. Taking our intellectual property, insisting that we have to put our intellectual property in China if we want to invest there. The fact that they are very restrictive about American companies making controlling investments in China, whereas we pretty much give them free rein. So that's one thing. I think there's some things which might be renegotiated, although renegotiation is tough. And one of them is the provision on so-called investor-state dispute settlement, which many people feel gives multinational corporations the right to go to some kind of international body where they feel that some provision or another of a country is damaging their proprietary interest.
Almost like take them to court, in a sense.
And that does upset a lot of people. So, as I say, there's better enforcement of the rules that do exist. There is possible renegotiation of some of these things. And although this is a tall order, the United States is less generous than almost any other industrialized country on what it does for workers in general who either lose their jobs or take a job at lower wages, whether it's because of increased trade or increased automation or a shift in consumer preferences. And the one provision that U.S. law has, TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance, was dismissed by labor as burial insurance. Now, if one could make the burial insurance into something real, which means, first of all, doing a more effective job of retraining people and helping people defend new jobs, and also to provide some so-called partial wage insurance, that is, if somebody takes a job at a lower wage than she or he had before, that the government in a limited way and for a limited period of time would partly make that up.
That could at least cushion the blow.
That could cushion the blow. Now, of course, it would cost money. Of course, in terms of deficit maintenance or reduction, that money would have to be found somewhere. So it's not an easy thing to do. And I'm laying an awful lot on Hillary Clinton's plate. I say Hillary Clinton because the other candidate, Donald Trump, goes so far in the other direction that there's not a lot of point in saying, well, what could he do to make TPP? I mean, the one thing, Trump has lots of inconsistencies. But the one thing, as far as I know, that he's been consistent about over decades is his opposition to trade, where he thinks we're getting a raw deal, and to immigration. So I think trying to persuade him on those things would probably be a lost cause.
I'm sure as an economist, you look at this point in our history. Where do you put this as far as the importance of our future economic health, the kinds of decisions that are going to be made by whomever wins tomorrow's election?
Well, by whomever wins tomorrow's election, I am deeply concerned. And I have to say, I, like many long-term academics, have a lot of my retirement money in TIAA CREF. Today, I converted all of the CREF part into cash. So I'm putting my money where my mouth is, if you like, because I really am deeply concerned. And there's differences between the candidates, and I don't pretend to be neutral, but whichever candidate wins, the gridlock in our political situation and the fact that in all political minds at the moment, the thing at the top seems to be to do in the other side rather than thinking about what's good for the country, I think has got to be very destructive. The kind of anti-trade and anti-immigration measures will certainly pull down our rate of growth. And since the whole industrialized world is growing very slowly anyway, and there's kind of what you might call a negative-positive feedback.
We've kind of seen this general global slowdown, yes.
Exactly. So I am pretty pessimistic at the moment. Right now, the United States, heaven help us, is the poster child for growth. Not that our growth is great, but everybody else's, and now I'm talking about the industrialized world. Everybody else's is worse. It's very hard to be optimistic about what will happen. And you see some of the same kind of anti-progress, if you like, forces operating in other industrialized countries, particularly in Europe. Everybody seems to be pulling in, battening down the hatches. And in a world where the private sector is as interdependent as ever, there seems to be a pulling back from any public government involvement in globalization. You know, that is really fighting tigers blind, if you like, where this increased interdependence could be a force for growth and for increased prosperity. And in some parts of the world, it already has been. There's been a huge reduction globally in world poverty in the last 10, 20 years. A lot of that is due to people, particularly in China and India, coming out of poverty. But we're seeing a shift, and it can't be good.
Marina von Neumann-Whitman, professor of business administration and public policy at the University of Michigan. It is great to get your economist perspective on our trade situation and the decisions that people are making at this point in our history. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
That's our show for today. Our director is Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.